Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll feature a presentation by Bob McChesney, research professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who discusses American media history and the future hope for a better American media. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report, but now, a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
At a Senate hearing last week, the public learned that the Federal Communications Commission chairman, Kevin Martin, had plans to rush through sweeping changes to the nation's longstanding media ownership rules by the end of the year. But North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan had a message for Martin.
The last time the commission did this, they decided in the largest American cities, it was perfectly fine for the Federal Communications Commission rule for one entity to own 8 radio stations, 3 television stations, the cable company, and the dominant newspaper. And that was just fine. Well, I'll tell you what, it sure ain't fine with me. If this is where the FCC is headed, there's going to be a firestorm of protests, and I'm going to be carrying the wood.
Kevin Martin initiated a new review of the rules in the summer of 2006. He committed to hold at least 6 public hearings on ownership, complete a proceeding on localism, and conduct independent studies on the impact of consolidation on local news and female and minority ownership. But Dorgan criticized that process.
There has not been a conclusion on localism. There's not been a conclusion on the proceedings of public interest. There is not possibly time by December to come out with the new media ownership rules out of the FCC and give any fairness to any group of people in this country to have the opportunity to comment on rules.
After the hearing, Dorgan co-authored a letter to Martin with Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, urging the FCC to slow down and consider all the facts before making any decisions. When Martin announced the final localism hearing would be held on October 31st in Washington, D.C., Dorgan and Lott pledged to overturn any new rules.
This is a big deal. We have way too much concentration of ownership in this country now. Way too much. And the suggestion that we should allow greater concentrations of television station owners, greater concentration of radio owners. I come from a state in which one company bought all 6 radio stations in one of our little towns. One company. And then to boot, let's throw in cross-ownership and let newspapers buy up radio and TV stations buy up newspapers. We'll all have a great time. Well, I'll tell you what, I think that's counterproductive to the public interest in this country.
To find out more about the media ownership issue, go to stopbigmedia.com.
The Associated Press recently exposed Comcast for blocking broadband subscribers who tried to upload files via a file-sharing network called BitTorrent. Not only did Comcast block the traffic, but it used a deceptive technique to disguise what it was doing. BitTorrent may not be an everyday internet application for many people, yet. It is meant for moving big files across the net quickly and cheaply. Adam Lin, policy coordinator for Free Press, explains.
When you normally download something off the internet, you go to a website and you click on a link and it starts downloading. And where it's downloading from is a server which the website pays for their content to be stored on and pays for upload speed. And what BitTorrent does is it distributes out that task of getting people the information. So the person who created the content doesn't have to pay such high fees and hosting costs to have it on a website.
Applications like BitTorrent are best known for quickly downloading movies and other entertainment files. But Lin says many businesses and other users are starting to recognize the value of this type of file sharing because it is a very efficient way to transfer information. Comcast claims they are simply managing the network to ensure a good quality service, but the evidence suggests otherwise. For one, Comcast's technology doesn't target individual users. It targets everyone using an application Comcast doesn't like. Secondly, Comcast's technology falsely impersonates its customers to intercept the transmissions. Such deceptive practices may be illegal and are a clear violation of network neutrality. Why would Comcast resort to such underhanded measures? Numerous content providers in Hollywood have contracted with BitTorrent to make their online programming available for downloading. As the internet grows and consumers understand how the quality and quantity of their video files can improve, File sharing will be an important part of moving web traffic, and Comcast views all this peer-to-peer sharing as competition to their own business model.
The long-term investment to build out your network, you're going to drive demand by doing that, not by inhibiting what customers can do online, by increasing what they can do online.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The disastrous events of 9/11 provided the excuse to move the United States closer to a full-blown police state domestically and to launch a general war of aggression internationally. Certainly, 9/11 was a godsend for the Bush regime, although a disaster for the rest of the planet. Just 4 years later, while Washington's global offensive was becoming mired in the sands and cities of Iraq, the Katrina catastrophe offered up another cornucopia of opportunities for the vultures whom George Bush represents. A black metropolis was quickly emptied, labor laws dumped into the Gulf Coast bays and bayous, public education replaced with privateers, and public housing bulldozed. Everywhere in the nation, neglected, failing neighborhoods signal future profits for the gentrifiers, quick cash for the most unproductive members of society. Were the Bushmen happy about 9/11 and Katrina? Damn right they were. These scavengers also revel in mass death in Darfur, which provides them humanitarian, diplomatic, and military opportunities to dominate the Sahel region of Africa. The list of welcome disaster opportunities can fill several books in addition to Ms. Klein's. Then comes the first of many great fires in Southern California. Immediately, the Border Patrol breaks the rules by mixing with local police and rescue workers. The conflagrations, they hope, will smoke out many of those elusive undocumented workers. Border agents and local lawmen embark on a depraved public policy whose predictable result is to further endanger the most vulnerable residents of the fire zone. Under the guise of protecting the public against looters, they set up checkpoints designed to catch immigrants fleeing the flames and invade San Diego's Qualcomm Stadium to check the papers of brown-skinned evacuees, threatening volunteers that try to intervene. In essence, these agents of disaster capitalism impose their own layer of state terror on an already terrifying situation. Meanwhile, it is left to the Mexican consulate to oversee relief to immigrant male farm workers, who are served by only one shelter in all of the huge county. Mexican firemen cross the border to help fight the flames, while the state of California complains that most of its National Guard is busy in Iraq. The owners of large farms refuse to allow their workers to evacuate, placing their cash crops above the value of throwaway human lives. The fires will come again to Southern California. Global warming assures it. But even more threatening to the social fabric of the region and the nation is the certainty that every disaster will be exploited by George Bush's breed of capitalists and by a much older, larger crowd of racists intent on adding misery upon misery, feeding the flames of eventual societal collapse. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a presentation by Bob McChesney, research professor in the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bob McChesney discusses American media history and the future hope for a better American media. The following presentation was recorded on Saturday, October 27, 2007, at the 2007 conference of the UDC, the Union for Democratic Communications, held at Simon Fraser University in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
UDC was formed, I think, roughly 25, 30 years ago. Does anyone know the exact? 81, so 27 years ago. And I think it was formed to link critical scholarship with activism. I mean, it was linked with a real commitment that the research we do as scholars should be linked to the real world conditions of, of our fellow members of the species in an effort to change this world for the better. And with a really strong critical bent that the existing structure of power, certainly in the United States and in most countries of the world, was inegalitarian and fundamentally undemocratic, and that communication was a central part of that process, and that changing the world for the better involved changing communication as a necessary and indispensable ingredient of broader social change. And I think that the best example we can give of the hopefulness comes in this organization itself. I mean, this conference, having attended several UDCs and been involved with the group in one manner or another for two decades, this is a fairly extraordinary conference. I was able to arrive today. I've been to three sessions, but three of the best sessions I've ever been at any conference, not to mention UDC. My bar is a lot higher for UDC than for other professional associations in terms of interesting work and valuable work. And I think that the talent, just in this room, I'm looking around while these phenomenal talks are going on, I'm looking at the people here and the work you're all doing, and I know a lot of you. There's a lot of talent here. And I think there's seven other sessions going on with some really talented people. There's a lot of, and I think that wasn't the same 10 or 12 years ago. I mean, I think there's a noticeable change. Dee Dee's not here. The old timers here, like us. It's really exciting to see this boom, this renaissance of critical work, of valuable critical work. And I think it exists because we're at a moment where there's a notion that the research can translate into social change, where it's not a hypothetical exercise, where you just, it's all hopeless, the neoliberals run the world, there is no alternative, and all we're doing is just sort of like memorizing baseball statistics. It's a total waste of time. Now there's a notion that the work we're doing, each of us up here, each of you, can translate into understanding the world so we can change it for the better. And actually that's a realistic, legitimate prospect. And that's really exciting. And I think that in a nutshell is what I'm going to talk about, how that has played out specifically in the media reform movement. I'm going to talk primarily about the United States, because that's most of my experience. Although in some of my other stuff I've talked about outside the United States, and I'm going to talk later today about sort of Canadian-U.S. Relations. But I think the starting point of UDC in critical scholarship and communication has always been the idea that the neoliberal line, that capitalism was the innate system and that a corporate commercial media system was the innate system. And that's how the default system of the human race, it just hadn't taken 100,000 years to get there, but the default system of the human race is always going to be corporate capitalism, profit motive, class inequality, and corporate media with advertising. That was how you naturally the system of the human race. We in UDC always knew that was propaganda, that was inaccurate, that our system reflected struggle, and that we were losing the struggle, but it was a system of struggle. It could be changed. There was nothing natural about this system. It existed because it benefited certain interests and screwed over many other people, most of the people in the world, and certainly in the United States. And I think that what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years, and I've been part of it, and a lot of people in this room have been part of it, is an increasing recognition that not only is the media system not natural anywhere than capitalism is, but specifically the media system, and not only is it dependent entirely on enormous government subsidies, direct and indirect, and monopoly franchises and licenses, we've all understood that, much more so than most other industries too. It's profit-driven, but it has nothing to do with free markets. Most of these big media and telecommunication companies wouldn't have a free market if it kicked them in the butt. It simply has nothing to do with free markets. It's profit-driven, though. And most of these big companies, their competitive advantage is in buying off politicians, not serving the public. That's where they're great. They own those guys who give them the monopoly franchises, who give them the cushy deals, who give them all the stuff we've been talking about here. But what we've come to understand, too, is this notion of critical junctures. That there are certain moments historically in which public action and scholarly action can have a much greater effect than at other times. There are certain moments in which the options before a society, for all issues in a broad sense, but certainly for media and communication issues, is much broader than it is otherwise. And from my own historical work and looking at the historical work of some of the people in this room and lots of other people, it's become clear that there have been distinct moments in American history, and they map differently in different countries. They aren't identical. There have been crucial moments in which our media system, the policies made, could have pointed us in very different directions, and there was a broad range. And then once a selection was made, it put you on a path that pretty much you stay on for a generation or two, and then it's pretty hard to get off it. My dissertation was on the critical juncture surrounding broadcasting in the United States and the efforts of people to set up a nonprofit, non-commercial system. I won't keep you in suspense, they lost. But it was a moment which there actually was a debate on that issue. And once they'd lost, for the next 50 years, it was assumed that corporate media was as natural in this country as the Rocky Mountain Range. You'd no more talk about getting rid of corporate media than you talk about blowing up the Rocky Mountain Range, you have an easier drive out to LA. It was just simply unthinkable. And so when new technologies came along, it was just assumed that television would be the province of corporations and advertisers, Madison Avenue, Wall Street. Just assume that would be it. Occasionally they'd throw some crumbs when the regulators, if there's a technology they didn't think you could make money off of, and let you have it until someone could figure out how to make money, they'd take it back. But that's also part of our history in this country. So what accounts for critical junctures? Well, I've written a lot about this, and I don't want to go into great detail here, but in effect in media, I argue that there are three factors, and if you get two of the three, you enter a critical juncture. One is a radical new technology which upsets the existing business system. We've had these going back to the telegraph, through to film and radio broadcasting, television. Now, of course, arguably the most significant of the last 200 years, the internet and digital revolution, which anyway, it's a culmination of all the movements. The second is a crisis in the content of media systems, and I think especially journalism, if there's a general sense that the journalism is inadequate or public affairs or media content. And the third factor that contributes to having a critical juncture is when there's a broader social crisis, when all the institutions of society are being held up to far closer scrutiny than at other times. The 1960s, the 1930s and 40s, the Progressive Era, Reconstruction, Jacksonian America, the Founding Republic, those moments in our history when we had a much closer scrutiny of all institutions. So media was just on the table there too. And I argue if you have two of those three, you're in a critical juncture. I think we clearly got the first two. I mean, we have the digital revolution. That even if you love corporate media, the corporate system's crumbling. They have trying to figure out how to make money in this thing too. So it's, even if you love the status quo, you've got to come up with policies to keep the status quo. So there's no default option. Journalism is in free fall. I mean, it's disintegrating. I mean, now you don't even have to give the evidence. I mean, it's just like you have to give evidence to say anything other than that. And a lot of people now, especially in the corporate community, I say, well, that's the internet's fault. If it wasn't for the internet, journalism would be great, which is utter nonsense. The crisis in journalism, as we all know, goes back. It's a crisis of tension between corporate, commercial ownership, and the nature of journalism goes back 150 years. And the modern crisis, the attack on professional autonomy, the lack of resources, the increasing politicization of direct politicization of media content goes back three and a half decades to the 70s. And already by the early 90s, there were major treatises chronicling all the stuff before the World Wide Web was even invented. So journalism's in crisis independent of the internet, but you put two together and you're in a critical juncture. The third element of this, which is the broader social crisis, well, I don't think there's anyone in this room, at least I hope there isn't, who's going to disagree with me that we don't have a recognition of it in our broader society, but it's long overdue. By all the traditional standards, like that Deepa was talking about, growth of inequality, corruption, militarism, I mean, just utter irrational insanity of a social system, we're well past the point where we should have a broad social awakening and uprising in popular politics. We don't have it yet. If we get that, then we get the trifecta. Then we're, the chances that we can build a communication and media system that's going to truly be progressive go way up. But even if we just had the first two, as I think we've learned in the last 5 years, we can still have a lot of influence. But ultimately, the success of the media reform movement in the United States and everywhere is closely hinged to the growth and development of popular politics. And the two are integrally related. They need each other to grow and survive. But the objective isn't, in the end, media. It's participatory democracy and living in a peaceful and humane society. A few quick words, because I think I take these notes and it's like, yeah, I've already gone close to my limits. I'll wrap up soon. Because I'd love to hear what people have to say and have a conversation. The media reform movement in this country responds to that critical juncture, the internet on one hand and the crisis of journalism, especially the crisis of journalism. And it grew, we can now look at a prehistory in the 1980s and 90s when there was a lot of growth of interest in media issues and media politics. And it exploded early in this century. Specifically around the media ownership fight in the United States that many of you are familiar with. But since then, it's just absolutely taken off. And the whole idea of the media ownership movement is that we simply have to make a public issue out of media policies, not let them be made secretly behind closed doors by powerful lobbyists and the politicians they own, and then hire ideologues to tell us that's the free market. And there's actually no hand of intent there by policymakers or public figures. And I think that that's been the whole goal of the movement, thinking the more public involvement there is, the better the policies, the better the system. That's the foundation of the entire movement. That's what drives it. And we've had a tremendous amount of success on a number of fronts. And I say we because there's a whole bunch of organizations and groups locally and nationally in the United States have been active. From media ownership, there's been battles on low-power FM, battles on funding for nonprofit, non-commercial radio and television, stopping corporate and government propaganda from masquerading as news, trying to make it possible for communities to set up their own broadband internet systems independent of the cable and phone monopolies, who are really emerging as like some of the sleaziest industries that we're facing now. They're becoming the dominant bad guys that we should all be familiarizing. So we don't have to use plural almost. They're whittling down to like three companies or four companies that completely dominate the telecommunication landscape. And then I think you're all familiar with the strong effort now of AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon to privatize the internet and assume the right to determine which websites come through and which don't online and also in their mobile operations. These campaigns, most of them we're in the middle of right now, have mobilized millions of people. The group I helped started the press. We didn't exist 5 years ago. Today we have over 30 organizers, 400,000 members. We're working on all these issues. And I just want to close by saying, I don't want to exaggerate our success, because if you see how powerful our enemies are, and then, you know, and you get outside, I mean, while we have millions of people who know about this issue, didn't know about it 5 years ago, we still got 275 million to go. You know, we got a long way to go. We're nowhere near the goal line. We're in midfield at best. Or at least we're on the field finally, though. That's the good news. And when you see how powerful AT&T is, you know, they had a meeting of all their lobbyists in January this year. They couldn't find a room in Washington, D.C. where they could all get them their Capitol lobbies in one room. It's so many lobbyists, they had to have a closed circuit TV because they have a single lobbyist for every member of Congress. That's a baseline. You start with one. If you're important, you get two or three. You know, but that's if you're on the committee. And so this is what we're up against. So we're mosquitoes going against a pack of dinosaurs. Even with 30 people, sounds impressive. Whoa. Yeah, it is really impressive. But, at the AT&T, we're a nuisance. But we're not, we got to get, not just our group, but this movement does understand what we're going up against. We can never be self-satisfied that we're sufficient. Just a couple final points that I will wrap here. Winning the ubiquitous internet, uncensored by corporations and government, at a reasonable price, if not free for all Americans, is good, but it's not sufficient. Even if we were to win those crucial fights, there are two things that we have to continue to fight for. One, journalism. Just having the internet alone, ubiquitous, isn't going to solve the crisis in journalism and the need that we all understand for journalism for self-governing society. The market has failed. Technology won't set us free. The task before us is to come up with policies, structures, ideas to really spawn a vibrant, competitive, public service-oriented journalism that serves the people of, in the case of the United States, of all the people of the United States, all the communities there, and that's true everywhere. That's going to be hard work. That's the job in front of us. And secondly, and this goes back to the first talk today, if the net result of the internet revolution is that we simply have given Madison Avenue a open vein shot into the DNA and central nervous system of the entire country at all times, that we're just marinated in commercialism, I think we'll all regret the day the computer was invented. Because that is really the physical manifestation of corporate power of neoliberalism. And that's got to be taken on directly. And this movement's got to go after both those two things ultimately to be successful. Okay, well, and there's a crucial role for all of us in it. Thank you very much.
That was a presentation by Bob McChesney, research professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who gave a presentation on October 27, 2007 in Vancouver, Canada. After Bob McChesney gave his presentation, I asked Bob a question.
A question for Bob. You had specified the three ingredients in for a critical juncture: technology, crisis in context, social crisis generally, and that we have two of those ingredients, technology and crisis in context, but arguably, and I think I would agree with you, that we don't have a social crisis, and that maybe it might be behoove us, for those of us working on this issue, to try to do what we can to improve our chances, to try to foment that, to improve our chances generally. But my question to you is, are there any instances where we actually had this hat trick, where all three of these instances in American history have occurred, that we've had the critical juncture with all three items?
You know, well, let me just go to the first part of your question first. I think we have the actual conditions for the measure of the broad social crisis is popular discontent organization. And we have the material objective conditions for that right now. We don't have to wait for things to get bad.
Okay.
They're there. We're there. Yeah. And I think in previous historical periods, we've had similar moments like this. We've had much more political activism. Mm. And that's a difference between this period and earlier periods in our history. You know, I think we've come closer in other periods. I think, for example, in the 1930s and 1940s, you had a new technology. You had journalism, and greatly discredited still, professional journalism was far from in the saddle in American newsrooms. And I'm talking about the United States now, again, because you have to change this country to country. And certainly you had the Depression and the rise of the labor movement. You had a broad social upheaval in the 30s and into the 40s. So I think you're closer. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but one of the problems of the period I studied with broadcasting was that the full political effect of the CIO and the social uprising, the left wing of the New Deal and the farther left organizers, really hit in the United States in the late 30s and into the 40s. And broadcasting was settled in the early 30s. And I speculate, it's a purely speculation, that had the three been in alignment, we might have had a very different outcome. For example, the CIO was adamantly opposed to commercial broadcasting. But by the time it came along, the system was in place, so all it could do is bellyache. The AFL, regrettably, was not of such a mind in it. With the notable exception of a couple of unions, the Chicago Federation of Labor, yeah. It very much worked to cement in the commercial system when it was in play.
That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.